Well, brethren, greetings once again on one of God's holy Sabbath days, which he's given to us, as we know, to help us to grow in our understanding of his way of life. The Sabbath days really are education days for us. For 6 days of the week, we're in this world, fighting with this world, earning our living in this world. But on the Sabbath day, we can cease from our weekly labors and spend that time looking through God's Word and drawing nearer to the one being who actually is wise and sensible. We're going to continue today with our Bible reading or Bible study through the book of Exodus. And as we've said before, at this time of the year, as we're just entering into the new sacred year, as we're within a few days of Passover and unleavened bread, it's a very good time to look at these incidents that took place way back in the history of our forefathers in ancient Egypt and in their escape. So we'll continue now, starting in Exodus chapter 14 and beginning in verse 1. Now the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea." You know, the 2, 3, 4, 5 million Israelites, however many there were, had of course fled from Egypt. They were now following behind Moses and behind that great pillar of cloud in the sky above them. And now God says, look, turn off the main route. Turn down towards the Red Sea, at which they did. Verse 3, "For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, 'Hey, they are bewildered by the land. They've got lost. The wilderness has closed them in. Oh, they've managed to get themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place, so to speak.'" Verse 4, "Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart," not that it took much hardening, "so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Eternal." And they did so. They turned off the Israelites towards this location. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" A strange question. In some ways, I can think of 10 very good reasons why they'd done that. The 10 plagues had just brought Egypt down to wreck, to rack, and to ruin. A great empire had now seen its agriculture destroyed, its firstborn killed. The people had suffered through plagues of boils and lice and darkness and so on. There's plenty of reasons why they let the people go, but it looks like Pharaoh had a very short memory. Verse 6, "So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him." So the Pharaoh is going to lead the way, going to chase these Israelites and teach them a lesson or two. "Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them." It seems clear that the cavalry, so to speak, the chariots, one of the main thrusting parts of the Pharaoh's army, fast moving. No doubt the captains and the soldiers and so on would be armed with spears and axes and who knows what not. Probably a fearsome sight when they'd come racing towards you, rumbling with the wheels, whirring and whizzing, and the smoke, dust billowing up behind them, and all of them out for blood. "And the Eternal hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-hahiroth before Baal Zephon." So not only were the chariots there and Pharaoh leading them, but also all his army. Now Josephus, who was the Jewish historian of the first century, he reckons there were 600 chariots altogether, 50,000 cavalry, and over 200,000 footmen. infantrymen, making, you know, an army of 250,000 of ruthless individuals, perhaps, out to get their own back on these Israelites. Now, whether Josephus was right or wrong with those figures, how accurate, I guess there's no way to tell. But it makes sense that a great empire like Egypt could have easily 250,000 cavalry and infantrymen. And here they come against the Israelites, who are now trapped between the mountains and the sea with nowhere to go. And we know this would be on the, as we come in towards the seventh day of unleavened bread. They left with a high hand on the first day of unleavened bread, the feast day, the 15th day of Abib. This was now 6 days later. It would be a Tuesday evening around sunset time as the Egyptians appear in sight. Verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, as you'd expect. This army, with vengeance in its eyes, and all that sight of power and might, it would be pretty frightening, I would have thought. Then they said to Moses, "Oh, God will save us, won't he?" Well, no. The first of many disappointments, I suppose. They said to Moses, "Aye, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die here in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians'?" As slaves, of course. "For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." You know, here were people who were, well, to be fair to them, had been a slave people. Confidence and courage, not very evident here. Scared, panicking, but already starting to accuse Moses. "Why have you done this, Moses? We told you, leave us alone. We're happy to be slaves here in Egypt. We've got food to eat and homes to live in. Why have you brought us way out here? We're trapped. They're going to slaughter us, and our children and our wives are going to lie here as, you know, hacked to pieces in the desert. Oh, woe, woe are us." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Eternal will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace," or be quiet, or basically shut up. And so he heard plenty of noise from these people, but he says, "Look, you know, haven't you realized yet, people, that this God, Jehovah, he's just redeemed us and delivered us from slavery in Egypt. He's brought the mighty empire of Egypt down till it's a wreck. He will fight for us. He will preserve and protect us. Don't worry by these apparent difficulties." And of course, that's something that as human beings, we all somewhat suffer from what the Israelites suffered from here. You know, when we choose to go God's way, to turn away sometimes from our families, when we hit sometimes job difficulties, when we come across perhaps occasional health problems, it's so easy, humanly, to get very downcast, very despondent, very concerned by these obstacles, these difficulties, these trials and tests. And sometimes we get very negative, and we can't see a way. On the one side of us is mountains. On the other side of us, there's an expanse of ocean water. There's no way out. We're trapped. We're defeated. We give up, or we want to give up. And that's often how it seems when we start to go God's way in particular. Extra obstacles sometimes appear, and of course, we can't ignore Satan and his demons. We are, I'm sure, very popular in Satan's eyes as targets. And of course, we should always remember that just as with ancient Israel here, God always makes a way out for us. If we hold our place there but turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, starting verse 11, You know, we may seem to be trapped. You look at all the physical evidence, and there's nowhere out that we can't do it. We don't have the strength. We don't have the finances. We don't have the intelligence. There's no way out. We're at the end of our tether, at the end of our rope. Only one thing to do, drop off and hope for the best. But no, 1 Corinthians 10, starting in verse 11, and in the earlier verses, Paul has been recounting these particular events. He's been talking about when Israel left Egypt. He's been talking about the serious mistakes they made in the wilderness. And now he gets down to his summary, verse 11. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. No complacency, please. But verse 13. No temptation, and the word temptation can be translated test or trial. It is exactly these three meanings. No temptation, test, or trial has overtaken you, except such as is common to man. Sometimes we think it's only me. Poor old me. The world never seen troubles like my troubles. But that's not accurate. We might sometimes feel that we are the center of everything. But all the troubles we've got, whether it's with in-laws or outlaws, whether it's health problems or financial problems or job problems or whatever it might be, frankly, there's plenty around sharing the exact self-same problems. But God is faithful. Worth remembering, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted, tested, or tried beyond what you are able, but with the temptation, test, or trial, will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So whenever we are facing severe temptation, test, or trial, we can know, if we believe Scripture, that there is the way of escape. There is the way of escape. And if we trust in our God who is faithful, he will make that way of escape available to us. And that's what took place over here in Exodus 14. If we turn back there, Exodus 14 and verse 14 again, Moses says, look, the Eternal will fight for you, and you shall basically belt up. Now at this stage it seems that perhaps Moses didn't actually know how God would defend them. He simply knew that he would. Moses had been there in Egypt. He'd seen all these plagues one after the other. He knew God was delivering these slave people to honor his promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So there's no question in Moses' mind, it doesn't matter how difficult this situation looks. I don't care if there's miles of water on one side, mountains on the other, and a quarter million trained soldiers heading towards us with javelins and spears and axes and clubs and so on. I know God will fight for us. I don't know how. I have no idea what he's going to do, but I know he'll do it. So verse 15. And the Eternal said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. Now, of course, that's impossible. You can't be there by the side of the sea and go through it. It's never happened. It's unbelievable. It's mission impossible. But God made it happen. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. And I assume that means all, meaning every last one of them. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. So there were two camps there, and obviously a gap of perhaps a mile or something between them. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, that's to the Egyptians, and it gave light by night to the other, the Israelites, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. You know, God kept the two camps apart while other things were happening. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. Again, who's ever seen this before? This was a first. And so, according to some people, the Red Sea at this point is about 8 miles across. We're talking of a serious body of water. And how deep it was, I don't know for sure. 50 feet deep? 100 feet deep? Pretty deep anyway, as we'll see later. You know, some people, scoffers I guess you'd call them, although some, you know, claim to be Bible students and so on, say that actually it wasn't the Red Sea, it was simply the Reed Sea, a sea of marshes, only, 12 inches deep. And so the amazing thing was that you could bring the Israelites with their carts and horses and cattle through this marshy area, the Reed Sea, with water about 6, 10, 12 inches deep. Well, that wouldn't explain what happened shortly. Verse 22. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And I do wonder whether the Israelites were confident they'd get through. As we will see from time to time, they never really did have confidence in their God. And even now I wonder whether some of them were, you know, elbowing each other and saying, I tell you what, he's going to drop this water on us. Another half hour in the middle of this, he's going to drown us all. I mean, that's what he's going to do. Moses is going to drown us all out here in the sea. I know he is. I'm sure he is. I suspect there was altogether too much people trying to, imply that God was out for their demise and not out to protect and deliver and bless them. Verse 23, and the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Not wise at all. Now it came to pass in the morning watch, and the morning watch, by the way, is not midnight. Some people try to say that morning in Bible terms means 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the middle of the night. The morning watch is called the morning watch because it's the watch which brings you up to dawn when it finishes, when the morning arrives. So that'd be perhaps something like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that. That the Eternal looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled or confused or confounded the army of the Egyptians. This would be the wee small hours of Wednesday morning. And he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Eternal fights for them against the Egyptians. You might have thought they'd have known that by now, but some people are, it's very hard to teach them a lesson. And of course in the end time, we know that even after the seals and the trumpets and the vials, the plagues, there are still some people unrepentant even at the end of that. It seems difficult even for God to convince some people of their stupidity. Then the Eternal said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Eternal overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them, not so much as one of them remained. And that's why, you know, a reed sea with 6 inches of water, that would hardly explain exactly how you managed to drown the entire Egyptian army in 6 inches of water. No, this was the Red Sea. Almost certainly the Gulf of Aqaba part, which is the Red Sea comes into two forks or two fingers in its northern part. One part goes to the northwest towards Egypt, which is the Gulf of Suez, and the other finger pointing to the northeast is the Gulf of Aqaba, And it seems that's probably where Israel crossed the Red Sea. And as it says here, no Egyptians left. But the children of Israel, verse 29, had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Eternal saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. You know, many would have sunk to the bottom, I guess, with their heavy armor. Others with less armor, I guess the sort of the currents and tide and so on would just sweep them up onto the beach to lie there, just dead horses, bits and pieces of chariot, dead soldiers all along the side of the shore. Verse 31. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Eternal had done in Egypt, so the people feared the Eternal and believed the Eternal and his servant Moses, which sounds absolutely fantastic until we find out just how short-lived their fear of the Eternal and their belief was. It really was, it didn't take much to, make it all disappear. Okay, chapter 15. And this is now the daytime period of the last day of unleavened bread. This would have been a Wednesday in that particular year. So Wednesday morning, a day has broken. The Egyptians are all dead now. And it's time for Israel to rejoice on that holy day from their deliverance. Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Eternal and spoke, saying, I will sing to the Eternal, for he has triumphed gloriously. And this is one of our songs, of course, from our purple hymn book, song number 116. I will sing to the Eternal, even the same title as the opening words here. I will sing to the Eternal, song number 116, brethren. Of course, set to music by Mr. Dwight Armstrong. I will sing to the Eternal, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Eternal is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him. Here were people at that time who certainly had a temporary good attitude and were very grateful and were lifting up God, extolling God and praising God, which of course is what we're supposed to do when we're singing the hymns before services, after services. This is one of the ones we sing. And God likes people singing to him. It's been recorded here in Scripture for us. Verse 3, the Eternal is a man of war. And we'll see a reference to that shortly. The Eternal is a man of war. The Eternal is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. The depths have covered them. They sank to the bottom like a stone. Which, like I say, if you've got heavy armor on, breastplate and carrying a shield strapped to your back and so on, then I guess you wouldn't be swimming very far. Verse 6. Your right hand, O Eternal, has become glorious in power. Your right hand, O Eternal, has dashed the enemy in pieces. And in the greatness of your excellence, you have overthrown those who rose against you. You sent forth your wrath, which consumed them like stubble. And with the blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The floods stood upright like a heap, and the depths congealed in the heart of the sea. My margin says, became firm. The water just became hard and firm. It didn't run all over the place like water is supposed to do. It just heaped itself up. And it was just firm, I guess. I'm sure some of the kids, perhaps, they're walking there between the walls of water and probably went across and poked the finger at it to find out, why is it doing that? And did it yield slightly, like a balloon perhaps filled with water? But anyway, it was there, congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be satisfied on them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. That's what the Egyptians thought. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them, they sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, O Eternal, among the gods? Who is like you, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. The earth swallowed them up. You in your mercy have led forth the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them in your strength to your holy habitation. Now, verses 12 and 13, quite interesting. There may be a sort of prophetic duality here. Notice it says, verse 12, you know, God, you stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed the enemy. It swallowed them up. In your mercy, you've led forth your people, the ones you've redeemed, guiding them to your holy habitation. Well, let's keep our fingers there and turn to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12, and we'll read verses 14 to 16. Revelation 12, starting in verse 14. But the woman, talking of the church of God, was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So here we have a situation where it appears God's church, God's people, are flying to their place of protection, the place of safety. Satan spews water, which might be armies of people, after the church, after the brethren. And what does it say happens? Well, the earth opens its mouth and swallows up those floodwaters, whatever they are, as God's people make their way to safety. So turn back to Exodus chapter 15. And verse 12, as it says there, you know, the earth swallowed up the Egyptians as God guided his people towards their holy habitation. So there could well be a prophetic duality there. Verse 14 now of Exodus 15. The song continues. The people will hear and be afraid. Sorrow will take hold of the inhabitants of Palestina. Then the chiefs of Edom will be dismayed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, will take hold of them. All the inhabitants of Canaan will melt away. So what the song says is, you know, the nations round about, when they hear of this destruction of Egypt and its entire army, and the Pharaoh and his chariots by this mighty miracle, it's going to absolutely terrify them. They're going to realize where a powerful God is in charge of Israel. Oh, wow. The Palestinians, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Canaanites, fear and trembling will overtake them. They'll be stopped in their tracks. And that's exactly what did happen. Again, if we hold our place there and turn to Joshua chapter 2, book of Joshua. Chapter 2. Starting in verse 1, we can read the story here of Rahab and the two spies who'd gone off to spy out this particular area of Jericho. Verse 1 of chapter 2 of Joshua. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go, view the land, especially Jericho. Because Joshua realized that would be a major a prize to take Jericho. It was a large walled city, well fortified, quite a test for Israel to come. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. So Rahab put them up, and of course the local king found out, sent out people to try and find these two spies, and Rahab, we know, secreted them, hid them away, and protected them. Dropping down to verse 6, but she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. So these two spies were hidden from the people searching for them. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. Of course, they hadn't gone that way. Verse 8, so before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, the two Israelite spies, I know that the Eternal has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Eternal dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. That was 40 years earlier. This was a generation earlier. Don't forget that the Israelites had been in the wilderness for 40 long years. All the adults of that time had since died. This is a whole new generation approaching Jericho. And here it says, Rahab, look, we all know, even though we're only 20 and 25 years old, we all know what took place 40 years ago when your God brought you out miraculously from Egypt, destroying Egypt as an empire. It's no longer an empire. It's been destroyed. And he brought you through the Red Sea. We all know about that. The word, everybody knows about it. It's terrifying to think what your God can do. Verse 10, for we have heard how the Eternal dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For Jehovah your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. So Rahab, even this prostitute Rahab, she knew the score. And like she said, all of them knew the score. They all realized that this God, the Israelites God, he is the one you've got to watch out for. This Jehovah God, he is powerful. He is mighty. And every single person, it seems, in the land of Canaan, they were trembling and their knees were knocking, wondering what's going to happen next when these Israelites come into our land. Okay, back to Exodus 15. And now on to verse 16, still talking about the state of mind of the nations nearby. Fear and dread will fall on them. By the greatness of your arm, they will be as still as a stone, till your people pass over, O Eternal, till the people pass over whom you have purchased. You will bring them in and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, in the place, O Eternal, which you have made for your own dwelling, the sanctuary, O Eternal, which your hands have established. The Eternal shall reign forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh went with his chariots and his horsemen into the sea, and the Eternal brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the children of Israel went on dry land in the midst of the sea. Then Miriam, the prophetess, I guess that's the first time we know that she's a prophetess, the sister of Aaron, and also of course the sister of Moses, because Aaron and Moses were brothers, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam answered them, it's like almost a refrain or a chorus to the song, sing to the Eternal, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. So all sounds really pretty positive at this stage, doesn't it? It's all good news. Singing and dancing and merrymaking and feasting. I should hope, really, and on a holy day after all, the last day of unleavened bread. And with a high hand and great encouragement, off they go. Verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Not perhaps a great surprise. It's a wilderness area. There's 2 or 3 million people perhaps here. 5 million people require a lot of water. And at this stage, well, there is no water. Now when they came to Marah, which is where they camped, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. So you get water, but you can't drink it. It's no use. It's toxic or poisonous. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. Now this place where they camped at Marah is probably a Sabbath day, because remember they had the feast day after the Egyptians were drowned and so on. That would have been a Wednesday that year. And now they move out for 3 days and camp at Marah. That brings them to the Sabbath. This will be the first Sabbath, you know, after they've left Egypt. And we'll just keep a track of the Sabbaths as we go, for a little reason, which is that I think we all know that Pentecost wouldn't be too far away now, because once you're in the days of unleavened bread and have got to the end of them, the next feast day for God is the Feast of Pentecost. How do you find Pentecost? Well, you count 50 days. That's what Pentecost means, 50th day. And you count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath. You've got to count your seven Sabbaths from when you start, and then you come to the day after the seventh Sabbath, which is Pentecost. So here we are at the first of those seven Sabbaths, and we'll keep track of them as we go, so one by one. And we can see that it brings us up to Exodus 20, which is when we come to Pentecost. So just a little thing to look out for as we go along. So here they are on that first Sabbath at Marah. And verse 24, and the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? You know, even yet, after miracle, after miracle, after miracle, it takes no time at all before they start to complain and grumble and murmur and, oh, woe is me, brother, the trouble I've seen. And so here they are, what shall we drink, Moses? So he cried out to the Eternal, and the Eternal showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. Pretty good. Another miracle. That must be it, surely. That's the last time the people will complain, won't it? Won't they? I mean, this is another miracle. This is final evidence. This is proof positive that God's looking after them. He's leading them, you know, by this pillar of cloud and the fire of the night time. He's telling them when to camp and when to move. He brings them to water and he converts it from bitter water to sweet water. This is it. This is the final evidence that even doubters would require that God's looking after them. Absolutely marvelous. What a wonderful place to come to in their spiritual maturity. And there he tested them, verse 26, and said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Eternal your God, you know, you can heed God's word without being diligent. You can be casual and compromise and spend 5 minutes a week in God's word. But if you diligently heed the voice of the Eternal your God and do what is right in his sight, so action required, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes. Interesting, isn't it? We haven't got to Exodus 20 yet. What commandments? What statutes? I thought they all began at Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments. You mean that there were already commandments? Of course there were. It's been murder to kill other people since the Garden of Eden. It's been adultery since the Garden of Eden to love another man's wife or husband and so on. But, says God, and this was really a Sabbath message if you think about it, this was the Sabbath day at Marah, waters made sweet, and now a message to the people. If you diligently heed God's voice and keep his commandments and his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Eternal who heals you. In the Hebrew, it actually says, you know, I am Jehovah Rapha. That's God's name. That's one of his titles. I am Jehovah Rapha. I am the God healer. I am God your healer. Interesting. As far back as then, God says, I am your healer. And of course, remembering that this particular being, the one who is called the Eternal or the Lord or Jehovah, is actually Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever. He was their healer then. He was still their healer when he walked about the shores of Galilee and down to Jerusalem in 28, 29, 30 AD. And he's the same today as he was then. He is still Jehovah Rapha, God your healer. So that was that particular Sabbath. Verse 27, then they left there and came to Elim. There's quite a few Pentecostal churches, at least here in England, that refer to themselves as being Elim Pentecostal. They came to Elim, where they camped again, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. So they camped there by the waters. They've moved on through that few days. This would be the second Sabbath, almost certainly. So if you're keeping a track, verse 27 tells us of Sabbath number 2 of the 7 that we count heading towards Pentecost. Sabbath number 3 is not mentioned here, and we won't turn to it, but if you're keeping notes, you could always refer later to Numbers 33 verse 10, which tells us of their next camp on a Sabbath day, because it would probably, as a norm, travel on 6 days and camp on the 7th, but they're third Sabbath camp was by the Red Sea. Numbers 33 verse 10. Now moving on to chapter 16, and we'll come up now to their fourth Sabbath day. And they journeyed from Elim, stopping off at the Red Sea en route, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which doesn't mean like transgression of the law, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt. Remember, they left Egypt on the 15th day of the first month. Passover was the 14th, the feast was the 15th when they left, and now 1 month later, the 15th day of the second month, they've arrived at this particular area, the wilderness of Sin. And that would be on a Sabbath day. You can count that out on a piece of paper if you want. If you go from leaving Egypt on the 15th day being a Thursday, which it was, then you get the 15th day of the second month being a Saturday. So this is the fourth Sabbath day of the count towards Pentecost. Verse 2. Oh dear. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel, all of them, murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. You know, it's no time at all since the waters were made sweet. That final convincing miracle. Nope, they were not convinced. They murmured, what, only 2 weeks later? And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Eternal in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you, Moses and Aaron, have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. You know, really, it's frightening just how unbelieving and carnal and short memory they had, and unfortunately sometimes we have. You know, it doesn't matter how many miracles it seems God does, people's memories are so short-lived. At the first sign of problems, suddenly all the confidence evaporates, and suddenly, oh, God's out to get me. You know, here we are in the wilderness. If he tricked us with that sweet water 2 weeks ago, now we're even further away from safety, and now there's no food. We're all going to die here, us and our children and the babies. Oh my word, why did you bring us out here to kill us? This is awful. Oh, we'd rather been back there with our faces stuffed full of double cheeseburgers and Coca-Cola and all the rest of it, and be slaughtered by God. And oh dear, and really it's frightening. And the frightening thing is that human nature, we've got it as well. Verse 4. Then the Eternal said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. Here's another absolute first. This is something that's never happened before. Another fantastic, innovative miracle. I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. So God's law already exists. He's now going to test whether they're going to be obedient to him. Here is a test commandment coming up, which we know, of course, is the Sabbath test commandment. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, at evening you shall know that the Eternal has brought you out of the land of Egypt. If you didn't already know, you thick-skinned, thick-necked people. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Eternal, for he hears your murmurings against the Eternal. But what are we that you murmur against us? You know, people really were, as they proved in later episodes, continually offending God by their absolute, almost complete lack of faith and trust in this being who was pulling out all the stops to deliver them and bless them. Verse 8, also Moses said, this shall be seen when the Eternal gives you meat to eat in the evening, and in the morning bread to the full. For the Eternal hears your murmurings which you make against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Eternal, because really all we're doing is following God's instructions. So when you whinge and complain and accuse us, it's really, is God really, people? And just in case you've missed the point here, people, it's actually, you know, people, it's God you're actually accusing, not us. We didn't open up the Red Sea. We didn't strike the firstborn in Egypt. We didn't bring in the hail and the meteors and so on. We didn't bring in the frogs and the lice and the darkness. Don't blame us. If you shout at us, it's the Creator God you're really complaining against. Be a bit careful. Then Moses, verse 9, spoke to Aaron, "Say to all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Eternal, for he has heard your murmurings." Now it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Eternal appeared in the cloud. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "I have heard the murmurings, the grumblings, of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Eternal, your God." So at twilight, once the sun's gone down and dusk is settling, you're going to have meat to eat. Verse 13. So it was that quails, birds, came up at evening, that'd be around sunset, and covered the camp. And in the morning, the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there, on the surface of the wilderness, on the ground, was a small round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "This is the bread which the Eternal has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Eternal has commanded, that every man gather it according to each one's needs, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent." And the children of Israel did so, and gathered some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who had gathered much had nothing over, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. So Moses said, "Let no one leave any of it till the morning. Make sure you scoff it all today." Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. What a surprise. But some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank. It decayed pretty rapidly overnight, and it smelled pretty awful, and there was things creeping about in it. Rather nasty, a bit like maggots, I guess. And Moses was angry with them, because, look, he said, "Well, have you got a problem, people? Go out and gather it, and prepare it, and enjoy it, but don't leave any for the morning, because you don't need to." One reason to keep it till the morning is because you didn't really believe there'd be any the next morning. You can't trust this Jehovah, can you? He's given us bread today, but you never know what God's going to do. Tomorrow, we'll go out, and there'll be nothing there. Just empty landscape. Tell you what, we'll keep some under the cupboard until tomorrow, just in case, as God lets us down. And that's what got Moses angry. Thinking, "Well, what's the matter with you? God said he's going to provide bread from heaven." In the Psalms, it's called, angel food. So, okay. Verse 21. They gathered it every morning, every man according to his need. And when the sun became hot, it melted. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses, that would be the elders, the senior men among the tribes and families and so on. And then he said to them, "This is what the Eternal has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Eternal." If you're counting, that's now Sabbath number 5 we've got to. Tomorrow, this being the Friday he's talking, "Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Eternal. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay up yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning." Tonight, leave some for tomorrow, and don't use it all up. Don't scoff the lot, okay, boys? Because tomorrow's the Sabbath, and you won't be out gathering in any of this this bread tomorrow. So, make sure you have enough to keep over until tomorrow morning, when, of course, it would normally have bread, worms, and stank. So they laid up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. This is yet another miracle. The thing that usually happens doesn't happen. It's preserved for 48 hours. Another miracle on top of the first miracle. Then Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Eternal. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. So here's a strong lesson about the Sabbath, ceasing from your labors, the Sabbath being a special day to God. Verse 27, now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. Now why do you suppose they did that? Presumably, they'd eaten the lot on the Friday, not believing it would be any different on the Sabbath, because who is this God anyway? These people seem to be so complacent, so lacking in faith, so disobedient, so downright carnal, and just like sometimes we might be. So they went out on the seventh day thinking, I'm a bit hungry now, got some of this this fancy bread that we find every morning. Oops, there's none there. Uh-oh, I'm going to be hungry. Verse 28, and the Eternal said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? You see, Sabbath keeping was a law of God, a commandment of God, you know, some time prior to the Ten Commandments of Exodus 20. This is still a couple of 3 weeks earlier. And already God's saying, look, the Sabbath is one of my commandments, one of my laws. How come you stubborn Israelites refuse to keep it? Verse 29, see, for the Eternal has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day, you know, to look for bread. Didn't mean you were stuck in your tent all day long, you know, twiddling your thumbs and getting carbuncles on your behind. You're allowed out of the tent to walk and enjoy fresh air and stroll with the family and so on and look at the surroundings. But you wouldn't go out, you know, trying to gather in your crops, or in this case, the bread. So the people rested on the seventh day. And the house of Israel called its name Manna, which is Hebrew for what's this? And it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. That sounds fairly pleasant, I guess, if you like honey. If you don't like honey, I guess you have to perhaps put some salt on it, or some Marmite, or perhaps some barbecue sauce, or whatever. Verse 32. Then Moses said, this is the thing which the Eternal has commanded. Fill an omer with it, that's I guess the container, with an omer's weight inside it, to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness, when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a pot, and put an omer of manna in it, and lay it up before the Eternal, to be kept for your generations. And the Eternal commanded Moses, as the Eternal commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. And later, of course, it was in the ark. And the children of Israel ate manna 40 years, 40 long years, until they came to an inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. So you think about it, you know, 40 years is a long time. And how many miracles took place every single day throughout those 40 years, emphasizing the importance of the Sabbath day. In 40 years, there'd be about 2,000 Sabbath days. You know, 52 Sabbaths a year times 40 years. That's over 2,000 Sabbaths. So every week, without fail, the Sabbath was kept special by God, just to drive home when the Sabbath day was, to drive home that this is God's Sabbath day. You'd better cease from your labors. And that was enforced Sabbath after Sabbath after Sabbath. On top of that, what an ongoing miracle. I mean, every single day, give us this day our daily bread. That's what we pray. And here the Israelites were given daily bread every single day, and enough on the sixth day to last for the seventh day. So for 40 long years, you know, all those days, they were given bread, showing daily God's protection of them, his provision for them, his care for them. You know, as a good shepherd, he made sure they got fed every single solitary day. And you would surely have thought that every morning they would have said, you know, glory to God. Here's more of this fantastic manna that God provides for us, even here in the wilderness, away from all the cities and towns and so-called civilization. God is giving us food every single day. A miracle day by day by day. An extra miracle on Sabbath, when it stays fresh for 48 hours. I mean, surely with those endless, continuous daily miracles, the people could never, surely, ever doubt God's desire to bless them and provide for them? Surely not. Let's carry on now in chapter 17. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Eternal, and camped in Rephidim, another camp, and this would be the almost certainly the sixth Sabbath day. So count seven Sabbaths until the day after the seventh Sabbath, went up to Sabbath number six in the count. But there was no water for the people to drink. Shouldn't be a problem, should it? Manna every day, and waters made sweet, and quail sent earlier. You know by now that God provides. By now you've got absolute implicit trust in this God who is looking after us, brother and sister, and oh, fantastic to be looked after by the great Jehovah God of the God of the universe. Oh, super duper. How could anything get better than this? Verse 2. Therefore the people contended with Moses, murmured, grumbled, and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Eternal?" And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, "Why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" I mean, this is almost getting to the point of being unbelievable. This is not only 2 weeks since they were murmuring over the lack of food. For 2 weeks now they've had daily manna, bread from heaven, angel food, for 2 weeks now. Surely, surely they've learned the lesson. But absolutely, apparently not. So Moses cried out to the Eternal saying, "What shall I do with this people? They're almost within a hair's breadth of stoning me." You know, they're about to pick up rocks and boulders and beat me up with them. That's how bad they are. These people are up in arms. They are agitated in a big way. They are getting, they're getting pretty angry. I think I'm in trouble with these people. And the Eternal said to Moses, "Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb." It's an area as well as being a mountain in its own right. "And you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink." Well, again, how can this possibly be the case? It's another brand new miracle. You go up to a rock and strike it with a rod, and out of a rock, a solid rock, comes water. Can that be? And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. You know, he struck that rock, and out came water. Enough water to pour down and cascade down and fill up all the containers and feed the livestock, as well as 2, 3, 4, 5 million Israelites. I mean, massive amounts of water, not a little tiny trickle, not a small stream, but oodles and oodles of water to satisfy the thirst of 3, 4, 5 million people, plus all the livestock. You know, amazing, really. You just got to think about the attitude of the people here, how quick they were to grumble, how quick they were to mutter. I mean, are we ever tempted to murmur or grumble? I mean, perhaps not us, of course. We are, you know, of course, saints, and we're above that sort of thing, aren't we? You wouldn't find us saying that things get us down, would you? I mean, because we know better, don't we? If God's on our side, who can be against us? We know the end of the story, as Mr. Armstrong said, and we win. The sufferings of this present time aren't worthy to compare to the glory which shall be revealed in us. We wouldn't complain and murmur and grumble about how things are bad and things are getting me down and I'm so despondent, I'm really depressed, you know. Not us, surely. Well, worth thinking about. Verse 7. So he called the name of the place Massa, which means tempted, and Meribah, which means contention, because of the contention of the children of Israel, because they tempted the Eternal, saying, "Is the Eternal among us or not?" Wow, really, I think it's very good that God's patient, because really after 10 plagues in Egypt, after destroying the firstborn, after delivering Israel by such mighty miracles and wonders, after opening up the Red Sea, after destroying the Egyptian army and the Pharaoh and so on, his chariots and whatnot, after feeding people now for several weeks with bread from heaven, giving them water, sweet water, quail, and what do the people say? Is the Eternal among us or not? Is God with us really? Do you think God's really with us? I don't think he is. Do you think he is? No, I don't think he is either. I mean, honestly, it's a mark of God's patience that he didn't obliterate them all on the spot. I think if I'd been a God being, that would have been the end of Israel. I don't think I could have took much more of this than this. But God was patient. He took it quite a bit longer before eventually he had enough of this lot. But notice, it's called Massa and Meribah. Temptation and contention, named because of what they were doing there. And really, it was a very serious incident. I mean, I'm sure that God really was not at all happy with the state of these people, about to stone, you know, his servant Moses, grumbling, complaining, and doubting him even at this stage. It's so incredible. And really, this particular event was perhaps in some ways a bit of a turning point. Certainly, it's quoted a number of times in the scriptures. We'll just look at a couple of them just quickly. Keep your finger there, as always. Turn to Deuteronomy 6:16. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16. Just one verse there. And Moses is recounting various things that took place. And he says, verse 16, "You shall not test your Eternal, your God, as you tempted him in Massa." So in a list of things to watch out for, he says, look people, don't, this is of course 40 years later now, don't you tempt God like that time you tested him back in Massa. Well, that was bad that day. Don't do that again. Or turn to Psalms chapter 95, which expands on it a little bit. Psalms 95. We'll start in verse 1. "O come, let us sing to the Eternal. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to him with psalms." And we should. Especially on the Sabbath day, we should come before God and, you know, and sing joyfully to him. Sing psalms to him. Because of all the good things and blessings, you know, that God's done for us. But dropping down to verse 7. "For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand." He cares for us. He watches out for us. He blesses us. He provides for us. We should know all of those things. We should trust in God. "Today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion," Hebrew Meribah, "as in the day of trial in the wilderness," Hebrew Massa. So we could leave that untranslated, which it says, "Do not harden your hearts as in Meribah, as in Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me." And they did test God. I mean, really, you were testing God's patience at that time to say, is God among us or not, after everything he'd done was really a tremendous insult and offense to the God who was doing everything he could to watch over and bless them. "When your fathers tested me, they proved me," or put me to the test, "though they saw my work." I mean, these people had eyes. They'd seen everything God had done. They weren't unaware of it. They weren't reading of it in a book, you know, years later like we do. They'd actually been through it. They'd experienced it. They'd seen it and tasted it and smelled it. "For 40 years I was grieved with that generation and said, it is a people who go astray in their hearts and they do not know my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." And that was the ultimate outcome for these people at Massa and Meribah. All the adults didn't enter the promised land. They died in the wilderness, and God swore, they will not enter my rest. And if you think that's just David, perhaps, the psalmist, talking about it, well, this same passage in Psalms is quoted in Hebrews 3 and 4. Won't turn there. But if you turn to Hebrews chapter 3 and 4 later, you'll find this particular psalm quoted, a large chunk of it. And we're told there by Paul that it was the Holy Spirit that said these words. So it was God himself pointing out this lesson here. Okay, back to Exodus chapter 17. And so they got their water all right, and in that sense were happy enough. You know, temporarily, of course. Nothing lasted very long with ancient Israel. Verse 8, now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, I think it's the first time that Joshua's name is mentioned, a man, of course, a great hero in his own right. Moses said to Joshua, clearly a strong leader already, choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him, took his men, his good fighters, and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Pretty interesting, really. I don't suppose Moses was just holding his hand up for the sake of it. I guess it was held up in prayer, really. Like you've seen pictures, and sometimes we can do it ourselves. You kneel there with both hands upraised towards heaven. Well, Moses had his hand or hands up towards heaven, no doubt praying and interceding for Israel. When he did that, they would be on top. When his hands got tired and he put them down, it swung the other way. But Moses' hands became heavy or tired, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. They ran him off. And we can see there, in a sense, that Moses couldn't do it all himself. He couldn't hold his hands up long enough, and he required help and support. Mr. Herbert Armstrong used to occasionally use this illustration and say, I can't do all my own, brethren. I need help. I need support. I need your prayers. I need your encouragement. And so, in a sense, we should try to hold up Mr. Armstrong's hands to help him to do the job. And he did a pretty good job, if you think about it. You can see the mess since he died. Moving on then to verse 14. Then the Eternal said to Moses, write this episode of war, this battle, write this for memorial in the book, and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Well, that's serious. This is Jehovah God speaking, and he says, get this written down in the book, Moses. Make sure Joshua hears this. I will utterly, totally blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, the Eternal is my banner, or in Hebrew, Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Eternal has sworn, the Eternal will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. God sworn that, and we're turning back from that. And you might wonder, well, what was it that really got God's nose so much about Amalek's fight? There were many times when Israel was attacked by one nation or one tribe or whatever it might be. What was so bad about Amalek? Well, of course, here's God bringing his people, Israel, out of slavery. He's taken them, by careful steps and in the right particular way, blessing them with food and drink and quail on the way. And here's God delivering his people, and suddenly the plans are interrupted by the Amalekites attacking them. But more than that, if we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25, we can find out something rather nasty about the Amalekites. Deuteronomy 25. And starting at verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when the Eternal God has given you rest from your enemies all around, in the land which the Eternal your God is giving you to possess as inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under the heaven, you shall not forget. So Amalek wasn't, in a sense, noble, didn't take on Israel from the front. He attacked at the rear, the ones who were the older ones, perhaps the younger ones, the stragglers, those that were the most tired and weary, the ones at the very back, and he attacked them in a sort of very cowardly fashion. And of course it was a complete offence to the God of Israel. And so Amalek showed no regard whatsoever for the God of Israel, and then tried to pick off the weak and the poor and the infirm and the ones at the back of the queue. Really sort of underhanded, and God didn't like that at all. It's interesting about writing this down in a book, in a sense, this particular battle, because it does turn out that God fought quite a number of wars on behalf of Israel, but we don't have a record of them all. But if we turn to Numbers chapter 21, verse 14, I must have never come across this till reading earlier. I must have read over this in years gone past and forgotten all about it. But to Numbers 21 and verse 14, we read here, "Therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Eternal," and it quotes from that particular book. So obviously there was a book called the Book of the Wars of Jehovah. The Book of Jehovah's Wars. It's not the Bible itself. This was a separate book, because you can see the next sort of few lines, it actually quotes from this particular book. So, there was a book written way back in those ancient days of the wars of the Eternal. Unfortunately, I guess the book's no longer available. It never made it into the Bible. It wasn't in that sense to be canonized with the rest of Scripture. But it must be a pretty interesting book, I would imagine. And perhaps in the world tomorrow, as a spirit beings, at least the content of that book will be available to us to find out about all the battles and how long they took and how many were killed and who did what and what time of day it was and how long it lasted. All the battles of the wars of the Lord will be there for us to read. Okay, well, I think that might do us for today. Not quite as far as I was expecting to get, but we're up now to Sabbath number 6, if you recollect. We're almost up to Mount Sinai. That's only a little bit further, which brings, of course, to Pentecost, to the giving of the Ten Commandments, and so on. But we leave that for another time. And so today, with that, we will conclude our Bible study.